This is Will Ortel from Inside Investing, and I'm here in New York with Jack Schwager, who has just written a book, The Little Book of Market Wizards. Now, Jack, this is a profile, a distillation of profiles of traders that you've written over the years. What does the word trader mean?
Well, to me, trader means, first of all, someone who is as likely potentially to go short as well as long.
Okay.
So it takes away this automatic long bias.
Mm-hmm.
That's one critical element to the word trader.
Mm-hmm.
And another element of it is, I think, a willingness to change position with maybe more frequency than someone you might term as a long-term investor.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the key elements.
Gotcha.
And in fact, it's odd because when I remember for Market Wizards, the first book, the first of the Market Wizard books, when I interviewed Jim Rogers, immediately, as soon as I stepped into his brownstone, he said, "I don't know why you want to interview me. I'm not a trader." So that was like, that was his like opening line. And I said, "Well, yeah, I know you invest long term,
mm-hmm.
but you know, in my mind, you are a trader because like I say, you will go short as well as long, and change positions and so forth. So in my mind, you are making decisions, and to me, decisions on when to go in, out, reverse positions. That's a trader,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to a long term investor who says, I want to have a 50% of my money in long-term in equities. I'm going to buy an index. I'm going to stay for 40 years. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's not a trader.
Yeah, it's a different thing. It's the directionality, but then how quickly you're reviewing it.
And it's also the reason why I never tried to interview certain people,
mm-hmm.
Because in my mind they were really invest. Because the theme of the book was trading,
gotcha.
Rather than investing. So going way back, and God knows Warren Buffett doesn't need to have any more. I mean, even if he would agree to have done it. There's been so much written about Warren that it's almost superfluous. However, I never even thought to ask Warren because in my mind, he really is an investor.
Gotcha.
And not a trader.
Gotcha.
And that's nothing wrong with that, obviously, because he's one of the most successful people as far as investments, trading, anything goes. So that's not a disparaging comment. It's just categorization.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Classification.
So if you were to take, this whole book, you basically distilled in the table of contents itself is a pretty good read for people, asking what sets a trader apart. But if you were to sort of elevator pitch what sets these guys apart from sort of the folks you might see on the street, how would you start?
Well, to be fair, I mean, the honest answer is that the whole book is an answer to that question, obviously. In fact, the whole book is a distillation from four books, which are each about three times the size of this one.
Yeah.
So it is already a distillation in its entirety. I've done some of these interviews, and people want, of course, to distill it more. And I had a similar question, and I said, if I was going to distill it down to like five essential points, and I always worry when I do this because I'm worried I'm going to do a Rick Perry on this. and he didn't get the three, so I got to go all the way to five. So first of all, to start out, you have to figure out what your approach is.
Mm-hmm.
People go into novices. I shouldn't say just people in general, but novices tend to believe there's some answer out there. It's not that successful trading or investing even is a matter of finding the right formula, the single right technique. They're always searching for this magic formula. And that's why books like How I Made $1 Million Trading the Markets always sell well. But the truth is it doesn't work that way. The truth is that there is no single way. No single way works continuously. If it did, it would stop to work anyway because everybody would follow it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a matter of finding a method that is right for the person. And it varies all over the place because there are people like, go back to Rogers, there are people like Rogers who have complete disdain for technical analysis and will, their attitude to technical analysis, the only people that they've ever, Rogers is the only person I've ever met, the only people who've made money techno-analysis, those that sell their services.
Yeah,
that's his take on it. And you got people like Schwartz, who've done phenomenally well, whose attitude is, I spent a decade as a fundamental analyst, lost money all the time. I got rich as a technician. So you get, and believe me, Rogers could never make money using techno-analysis, and Schwartz could not make money using fundamental analysis, yet they both do terrifically well, you know, in what they ended up doing. So,
yeah.
So the very, very, very first thing to get across to people is you've got to figure out what is the right method. It's not just fundamental versus technical. Are you short-term or long-term? You want to trade stocks? You want to trade futures?
Yeah.
You want to trade currencies? And on with the variations. And it's a discovery process, an evolution process. Nobody can tell you that. I get emails from people sometimes. They'll say, what method would you recommend? And I when I write back, or if I get the question in an audience, I got an email saying somebody, I'm going to buy a hand-tailored suit. I'm going to buy a suit, expensive suit. What size should I get? Well, how would I know? I don't know if you're 6'6 or 5'5.
You know? Yeah.
So you can't answer that question. There is no answer to that question. There is no right size suit for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And people need to think of trading the same way. There is no right size trading method for everybody. So the very first thing is you figure out what you got to do. And that involves reading different books, seeing what makes sense, watching the markets, experimenting. It's an evolutionary process. So, okay, so you get to that step, you do your work, you do your research, you do your market monitoring, and you get to a point where, okay, you're comfortable with certain things, you're involved with certain things you believe in that seem to work and so forth. So then you develop a method. Okay, so that's number one, is figure out what your approach is. Second, the approach has to have an edge.
Yeah.
It's not enough to just have, you know, an approach that you're comfortable with. It has to actually can make all the sense in the world, and that's a lot of people will make, well, on paper it makes all the sense, it sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
But the markets
work,
don't pay off for approaches that make sense sounds reasonable. They either, you know, they pay off for what works or what doesn't work, and what works may often be very counterintuitive. So you have to verify in some way that approach, whether it's, you can begin with paper trading and just monitor it, which is not quite the same, but still it's something. But you have to get some sense of feeling and confidence that approach that you've evolved works to some, you know. By work, I don't mean it's a money machine. I just mean that over time it's making more than it's losing. It's a methodology. It's okay.
Yeah.
So that's the edge. That's number two. Number three, and these are not in order of importance, they're in sort of chronological order, actually. Because you develop the method to write for your personality, it has to have an edge, and then when you're implementing it, part of the implementation process part of the planning process has to be risk management. Because you can come up with a great entry, even figure out maybe reasonable spots to get out, you can have a method that has an edge, but if you don't take risk management into account very seriously, and your approach leaves you open to having single trades or a small number of trades lose a lot of money, then you can just be, a good approach could be sabotaged by a few mistakes. You never want that. You never want to be at the mercy of having a few mistakes knock you out of the game.
Gotcha.
And virtually every trader I've interviewed said the risk management part is more important than the method. So that's the third part. Okay, so you got the key ingredients, but it all doesn't mean anything unless you implement it and implement it consistently, or another way of saying that is discipline.
Gotcha.
So you need the discipline to take your method with the edge and the risk management and stay true to it. You know, there are trades that are going to look scary and that you're going to really not want to take, but if it's part of your methodology, you take it. And there are times your methodology, what your risk management tells you, here's where you're out, and you may hate to get out, but that's your methodology, that's your risk management, you get out.
Yeah.
So you have to be strict on the discipline part. So that's the fourth thing. And the last ingredient, the fifth one, and I don't mean that there's just five, but I'm saying I'm sort of boiling it down to, if I had to boil it down to five essential points. The fifth part of it is the flexibility. And it's another trait that separates great traders from just everybody else. And is they're able to change on a dime. They can be wildly bullish 1 minute, and if something happens to change their mind, they're able to be wildly bearish the next. And that flexibility to be able to change your mind and not hope that your position is right is an essential ingredient.
I noticed that you had that anecdote about going to see Paul Tudor Jones 1 week, and then 2 weeks later he completely flipped his mind.
Yeah, that was that's true of Jones. It was true of a number of traders. So it's right. Jones was bullish on the stock market when I saw him. 2 weeks later, he's bearish, and that's. Same thing with Stevie Cohen. I interviewed him, and I know Stevie Cohen has his controversies and all of that. But if you just look at it as a statistician, and regardless, whatever the most wild assumptions you might want to take about, if I'm not saying that any of his trades were, but if some of his trades were, or some portion of his trades were influenced by insider trading, no matter how large you make that number, his track record is so good, you can cut it in half and cut it in half again, and it's still better than almost everybody else. So I have no question that he is, I'm not opining here on anything to do with insider trading. I know nothing more than anybody else does. But regardless of what that is, I have no doubt that Cohen is a great trader. And Cohen, when I went to sit with him one day, he was, again, wildly bullish. He was very, very, he gave me all these reasons why he's bullish the bond market. And I was there like a week or two later, and he's giving me all these reasons he's bearish. I don't even know if he remembers all the reasons, that 2 weeks earlier he'd given me the complete other side of the story. It's not important. These guys change their mind when they see the facts are different.
And they have it seems like they have opinions in given time horizons.
That's right.
Their
opinion is good for the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
It could perish in a second.
Yeah, it reminds me of like when the facts change, I change my opinion.
Exactly.
What do you do?
Right? Yeah. I forget who's what do you do, sir? I forgot whose quote that is.
I'll attribute it to Mark Twain because that's the safest way to do it.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah.
It seems like. You take those five steps, but it's really kind of a stupid question that I asked because, what you're really saying is that it's a process of self-discovery and, it really takes a lot of, knowing yourself. In addition to these sort of more mechanistic things, you kind of have to be in tune with who you are a little bit in order to hack it. Would you agree with that thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of, finding a method that fits your personality. So I say, you have to do something that works for you, that's comfortable and works for you. So it's not that's why it's a mistake for people to try to get somebody else to teach them their methodology and I'd like to work for Market Wizard. I'll work for nothing. Could you recommend? And it's a desire to get the methodology, but it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of finding somebody to teach you their methodology. You can learn from people, and certainly a number of the people in my book learned from other people, mm-hmm. but they still had their own methodology.
Yeah, and that gets to the question I wanted to ask, which is, sort of, is there like a look or something? Like, did all the successful traders go to Harvard Business School, for example?
No,
of course not.
Yeah. Some of them went to Princeton. No. There are... I think it's become more a characteristic of the modern hedge fund world, and because it's the way people getting jobs within hedge funds is, the people from the Ivy League schools have the better shot and so forth. So you get an overrepresentation of that. Certainly, so there are a lot of hedge fund managers that go in Ivy League schools, but as far as the people I've interviewed, they fall all over the map. I mean, some dropped out of college, in fact, and so it's not a. It's not necessarily just people with book smarts. There's a different type of intelligence that goes with trading. In some cases, it depends on the methodology. If it's a high quant methodology, then having the PhD from Princeton in mathematics is probably beneficial. I wouldn't argue that, and certainly there are people who've developed. There have been great traders. Well, I mean, I've had a number of my
Dave Shaw, or
Ed Thorpe. I mean, these guys are just sort of several deviations off the IQ scale. No question, super brilliant people, and no question that brilliance was responsible for the quant methodologies that they developed. But you have other traders who are not a matter of book smarts and may not be using that type of analysis at all, or any real quant stuff. They just got a good feel for the markets and have a way of taking lots and lots of different facts and distilling down what's important and a good representation of that might be someone like Mike Marcus. Now, he's no dummy. I mean, he's a master's in psychology, but he wasn't a quant guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, this was a story that I heard. I don't not from Marcus. I don't know if it was Marcus that told me, but I think it may have been Avitraders, a commodities corp, that told me the story. And commodities corp, for those, I guess maybe not everybody in this listening audience will know, they may have heard of commodities corp. Not everybody's going to know about commodities corp. It's kind of a fascinating story, but commodities corp goes back to the '60s, and it was this originally founded by quants. Who were trying to do a trading company, hire traders. And they were looking for basically quants. And Helmut Weimar, the founder of the company, I forget what his discipline was. It was mathematics or econometrics or whatever. Michael Marcus said of Weimar. Weimar wrote a book on analyzing the cocoa market. Marcus's comment about the book is that the book was so complicated I couldn't understand the cover. And that was so. Anyway, so Marcus said they had always been hiring quants, and they hadn't done that well. Mm-hmm. Also, an interesting tangent on this thing was that Paul Samuelson, who's famous as one of the big proponents, famous for many reasons, but he was also a big proponent of the efficient market hypothesis. Oddly enough, was one of the was part of Commodities Corp. He was on the advisory panel.
Oh,
or whatever.
You're kidding.
Yeah. So it's very
wow.
Very 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 odd fact. So anyway, they were interviewed traders. They interviewed, then they got to Marcus, and the joke was, one of the guys said, "Well, what does he do?" And the other one says, "Well, he just trades." Well, but what do you do? You mean, which academic articles has he written? What is he? What science has he done? And the answer was, he just trades. It prompted a laugh around the table. It was very humorous. He just trades, But Marcus went on to become by far the best trader that they ever had. Although I by far not quite by because Marcus then hired Kovner.
Okay.
So Marcus,
yeah.
And Kovner, Kovner was also phenomenal. But between but that was his hire. That was Marcus's hire. Marcus brought Kovner in. And Marcus and Kovner were like 99. They made Commodities Corp.
Yeah.
So now Marcus was a guy who was not a quant guy, but he had this emotional, he had this real connection with the market. There's a personal story here which applies. Marcus and I used to. I met Marcus because when I was getting my first job as a Wall Street analyst, the job I was taking, he was voluntarily vacating because he was going to become, in quotations, a trader. And so he was leaving this analyst position to become a trader. And I met him when I was, coming in. We talked a little bit. And he was still in New York for a few years before he went out to Malibu. And we used to get together for lunch. And I remember this instance where I was an analyst. At that time, I was really a fundamental analyst. And I was talking for a number of markets, one of which was cotton. And as a good little economic graduate, I did, all the basic analysis. I went back. I studied the economics of every cotton market in the post-World War II period and decided that there were like three or four markets at that time that would qualify as free markets because in all the other years, the government program kicked in and it distorted the price, so you really couldn't tell what the true equilibrium prices would have been. So I was left with just those 3-4 years, and then based on an analysis, really there wasn't enough data to form it, and that's what I should have said. But I came up with the conclusion that season was the most bullish, as bullish as the most bullish free market season we had, and prices were about 25 cents at the time, and the highest we'd ever had was somewhere in the mid-30s or whatever.
Okay.
And so that was my projection, which was good as far as it went, but I also believe that once we got up to the mid-30s, it's getting pretty high, and the market's fully priced.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's where the difference between somebody like myself, who is doing things analytically, and Marcus comes in. So Marcus, and I remember discussing one lunch in the economy, he said, I think it's, and I was at this point starting to short cut, and just I figured, it was like getting to the point where it should be topping out. And Mark says, it's going much higher. And the reason he thought so was because it was the first year that China, which was then called the PRC, was a buyer of cotton. And there are 1,000 facts out there about cotton, but he understood that this one fact, that the PRC was the buyer for the first time, changed everything.
Gotcha.
And he was absolutely right. Cotton didn't stop in the mid-30s, mid-40s, mid-50s. It went all the way up to 99 cents, which was the highest price cotton had ever seen in the, since the Civil War. Wow. And but he got it right, and he made a fortune on that market, even though I did a lot more analysis and more work, because he understood the one fact that mattered.
Gotcha.
And that's the thing. So you don't have to be a D.E. Shore or Annette Thorpe to make money to markets. It's a different approach. He found his approach was one that worked for him, and he had that type of market intelligence that is not so much book smarts. It's an intuitive smarts.
It's kind of wisdom a little bit.
Yeah. It's smarts, but it's a different type of smarts than we think of. It's not the type of smarts that's going to show up on a calculus test, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And the one fact that mattered is a provocative statement. I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I mean, so you know, given that, I mean, how would you, if you were to draw the line between, you know, what constitutes an investment and what constitutes a speculation? Where would you?
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit before. So essentially, yeah. You know, my line is, investment speculation. That's different. I'm sorry, speculation. I don't think I like the word speculation, because speculation has a tone of it about it implies a form of gambling, and gambling has nothing to do with trading. It shouldn't. I mean, I shouldn't say it has nothing to do. When it does have something to do with trading, then something is wrong. It has nothing to do with intelligent trading. So, insofar as speculation may sometimes be used as a synonym for gambling, then it's not the same. It's not what we're talking about. If it's used in the sense of taking a bet that has an edge, like, you know, somebody's offering you $2 for heads on a fair coin and paying you $1 for tails. If you want to call that speculation, you can call it speculation, but that's different.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not taking a bet like the casinos offer you, where you win when you have a 45% chance of winning and a 55% chance of losing, depending on what the game is, and that's pure gambling. And if speculation is used in that sense, it's gambling. So
yeah.
I think speculation is a bad word because it's not clear in what context.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say if it implies gambling, then it's negative, and it should be done. And if it implies an intelligent expected gain is a more precise word, that the expected that there is an expected positive gain to the transaction,
mm-hmm.
then you want to call that speculation, fine, but it's really just it's a form of trading.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch. Yeah, so there's basically a dirty word inside of speculation.
Well, there's a nuance. It's one of those words that it's not a clear word.
Yeah.
Because it's used in both contexts.
That makes a lot
of
sense.
And so I'd either talk about trading or I talk about gambling. Then it's clear.
Gotcha.
And unless, of course, if you're trading like a gambler, but then that's really not trading.
Gotcha. So you know, I want to wrap up. And, I mean, you've given a lot of this sort of along the way, but I wonder, you know, if we were to, after this interview, go on the street and pick a person at random, and they go, Jack Schwager, I love your books, I just read your new one, what should I do, how should I be managing my money?
So is this somebody who isn't trading now, or hasn't traded?
Hasn't been trading, and is now enchanted.
Or I get it from students. I get, you know, a lot of times I get questions from students and whatever. And the answer, my general answer is, okay, here's the process. The process is first read.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you what to read. Just go explore, you know, whether it's on the web or go to a library. Just go to a bookstore. If you can still find one these days, that's a challenge in itself. But however you do it, just pick up different things, look at different things, and you'll find you'll find what you gravitate. Okay, once you figure out where you're gravitating to, you know, read more on that. Then start thinking about it on your own, start thinking about ideas based upon what you read, and start looking about how you might implement them in the market. And empirically, watch the market, take those ideas, try different things, and then eventually try to develop that into some sort of methodology that you could define rules with, come up with a risk management plan,
mm-hmm.
and once you have that in place, paper trade. Paper trade's not the same because you don't have the emotional thing, but at least at the very basic, it's a way of checking whether do you really have an edge. And if it seems like you do have an edge, then start with a small amount of money,
mm-hmm.
And implement it. Now, that'll make it real, And I say small amount of money because most people will lose when they start trading, so you might as well get the education cheaper.
Yeah.
No reason doing a $50,000 degree when you can get one for $5,000, you know, so whatever.
Yeah.
Or you, it's up to whatever numbers you want. And then, of course, if you're trading with real money successfully, then gradually increase it as you feel comfortable. That's basically the line of progress that I would recommend.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Jack.
Sure. Enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thanks.